Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, February 22nd, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with a fun article from Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer, from Monticello. Allerton Outhouse is in, subtitled Room Without a Few, PHEW, solar-powered composting toilet offers relief at Allerton. Just when you thought eco-friendly outdoor restrooms couldn't get any more exciting, along comes the Allerton Park and Retreat Center with a new high watermark in green bathroom technology. Say a relieved hello to the Clivus Multrum composting toilet, clad in rustic cedar planking and, since December 11th, standing sentinel in the parking lot at the head, so to speak, of the Buck Schroth Trail in the 1,500-acre site near Monticello. Clivus Multrum means inclined chamber and uses technology pioneered in 1939 by Swedish bathroom genius Rickard Lindström. The sloping chamber hidden beneath the waterless toilet helps separate liquids and solids, while a sawdust medium, fed by copious amounts of fresh air breathed in by a solar-powered fan, which also keeps the facility non-smelly, hastens microbial composting. Now, with a manufacturing seat in New England, Clivus Multrum Inc. says the compost from the toilets it ships in kits all over the nation is completely benign. In fact, it's so flush with nutrients that when periodically raked out of its holding tank for replacement with new sawdust, the composted stuff contains nutrients which are valuable for fertilizer. Derek Peterson, Allerton Park's Associate Director of Park Operations, first bumped into a Clivus while visiting the splendidly named Hahatonka State Park in Missouri with his wife, Katie. Peterson says that, given the grim reputation of other non-sewer-connected outhouses for being odoriferous and looking pretty obscene, his wife normally refuses to darken their doors. But she went into one of these out there and found it to be fine, recalls Peterson, 34, and if my wife can take it, everybody can take it. Allerton Park is crisscrossed by 14 miles of running and walking trails and boasts 14 formal gardens interspersed with vast wild and wooded areas. It has some regular restroom facilities here and there, but was feeling growing pressure from its 100,000 visitors a year to provide more relief out in the sticks. Peterson says the self-supporting park, left in trust to the University of Illinois by philanthropist Robert Allerton, prides itself on being ecologically friendly while serving the public good. Acquiring the solar-powered and composting Clivus would fulfill both requirements and represented the bathroom equivalent of hitting a hole in one, if only he could come up with the $18,000 price tag. Happily, Allerton Park has friends who appreciate the golden arc of outhouse innovation and don't mind splashing around some cash for a good cause. Enter the University of Illinois Student Sustainability Committee, which has supported many previous green Allerton projects and dropped $15,000 toward making this one happen after Peterson asked them nicely for help. The committee gets its money from a $14 a semester tax the students charge themselves and then go off seeking worthy causes related to the university that need a hand. The Clivus struck them as particularly deserving. There is a lot of perception that if something is green and sustainable, it's all granola and back to nature and can sometimes be kind of gross, says Micah Kenfield, the student sustainability coordinator at the university. But this facility is modern and clean, and well, if you didn't know it was turning everything into compost, you would think this is just a great modern bathroom, right? The rest of the money needed was topped up with a contribution from the appropriately named Second Wind Running Club based in Champaign-Urbana. They stage a major Allerton Park run every year, and their 500-strong membership regularly pounds Allerton's glorious byways. The club has also helped with many park projects, and Ben Newell, a Second Wind board member, says dipping in to assist this time was kind of enlightened self-interest. The more hardcore trail runners make do, he said, describing how the park has lots of trees to seek out if the urge to encounter relief while running becomes insurmountable. But it is really nice to have some more modern and nice facilities along the way. If all goes well, Allerton will be looking to add a few more composting way stations in the future. Peterson says the place has vegetable gardens too, but isn't sure the gourmet world is yet ready for a cornucopia of produce fed on stuff we've eaten before. Yeah, well, that might be a little bit too much, he says. The article is accompanied by photographs. The first one, a man standing by the cedar-covered outhouse with the door open. Derek Peterson, Allerton Park's Associate Director of Park Operations, shows off the new $18,000 Clivus Multrum composting toilet with solar-powered fan. Another photograph has Peterson pointing out the new restroom located at the head of the Buck Schroth Trail. More alfresco bathrooms are planned. Another article from the front page, this one by Dan Petrella, the Herald and Review Springfield Bureau Chief. Public school funding becomes priority. Overall hike possible, equalizing in doubt. From Springfield, Illinois public schools have been largely unscathed in the budget battle that has been roiling the state for the past year, and Governor Bruce Rauner would like to keep it that way. In his budget address last week, Rauner called for increased funding for early childhood, elementary, and secondary education, and for it to be dealt with separately from any other issue. The first-term governor exempted schools from the current budget impasse, now in its eighth month, by signing an education funding bill last summer while vetoing the rest. We must make the education of our children our top priority, Rauner said Wednesday in his speech. The one thing I won't back down on, the one thing that's non-negotiable for me, is increasing education funding. But the Democrats, who control the state Senate, say pumping more money into a system that's created the widest gap in funding between high-poverty and low-poverty districts of any state would perpetuate the inequalities that have plagued Illinois schools for decades. They want to overhaul the way money is distributed to get more help to poorer students. State Senator Andy Menar of Bunker Hill, the Senate Democrats' point man on education funding, said the current setup, which was created in 1997 and relies heavily on local property taxes, needs to be addressed before spending more money. Throwing another log on the burning fire isn't going to put the fire out, Menar said. The governor's proposing spending millions more on schools in a broken system. That doesn't fix inequity, and it never will. Rauner proposes spending an additional $55.3 million to fully fund general state aid to public schools for the first time in 7 years. That money is supposed to ensure that each district has enough funding to provide every student with an adequate education. But Democrats say that because of the way the system is set up, some districts would still receive less state support than this year. Rauner also would spend $75 million more on early childhood education, which would keep more than 85,000 kids in preschool and create 2,900 more full-day preschool slots, the governor said. But his proposal would eliminate grants for expenses such as agricultural education, arts and foreign language courses, and the After School Matters program. State Senator Jason Berrickman, Republican of Bloomington, who, like Menar, is interested in overhauling the way schools are funded, said he supports the governor's budget plan. I'm all for rewriting the formula, but we also need to do that which we can do in the short term, Berrickman said. Until we get that fixed, we should work within the system that exists and fund it fully. He's sponsoring a bill that would create a panel to craft an evidence-based adequacy and equity formula for the funding of all school districts. It hasn't gotten a hearing. Menar, meanwhile, is preparing to introduce a new version of his overhaul bill, which is designed to funnel more money to poorer districts. Senate President John Cullerton, Democrat of Chicago, said any change to the formula should include Chicago public schools, which the current system treats separately. There should be one formula for the whole state, Cullerton said after Rauner's budget speech, and the goal of that change in the formula would be to focus education dollars where there's a concentration of poverty. The financially troubled district, the largest in the state and third largest in the country, is a complicating factor in funding discussions. The Rauner administration late last week announced a probe of the district's finances, and the governor has proposed bankruptcy and a state takeover as options, options Democrats flatly reject. Another complicating factor is that House Democrats haven't indicated whether they'll support plans their Senate colleagues are putting forward. House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat of Chicago, has reconvened a task force to study the issue, which last week held its first hearing of the year. After the budget address, Madigan reiterated his support for a tax on income of more than $1 million to bolster education. The measure, which would require an amendment to the state constitution, received overwhelming support in an advisory referendum on the November 2014 ballot. School administrators and teachers agree that new revenue is needed to fund schools and that the current formula is flawed. This really comes down to revenue and the need to put more money into education and other areas of the budget, said Jim Reed, Director of Government Relations for the Illinois Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. Mike Chamness, spokesman for the Illinois Association of School Administrators, also said more revenue is needed to adequately fund the state's schools. The organizations likewise agree that changes to the formula need to be done in a way that prevents any district from losing state funding. The school administrators believe there is room for compromise between Menard's ideas and the Berkman bill, which was based on the group's recommendations, Chamness said. We do believe that there is room there to help hold harmless districts in Illinois and to provide new revenue for the poorer districts, he said. But Menard cautions that that kind of thinking could block the necessary changes. If the reform effort is predicated on the position that we can't have any losers, then the price tag is going to be so high it may not even be achievable, he said. And now from the local page. From Decatur, Oak Grove kids flip over kind actions. This is an article by Valerie Wells, Herald and Review staff writer. One sure way to electrify a room full of elementary students is to do a backflip, and it definitely worked for Sharon Browning at Oak Grove School on Friday. I wanted to get them to listen, and I wanted to get their attention, the sixth grader said with a grin. His message, right before the backflip, was, "Kindness is cool." The occasion was a wrap-up report on the week's Random Acts of Kindness, a national event in which Oak Grove participated, said Abby Steele, the school's social worker. She's known about the week for a couple of years, but had never encouraged the school to participate. This year, she organized the week-long observance, and while teachers gave the kids guidance, most of the ideas came from the children themselves. Kindergartners collected items to donate to the animal shelter and made placemats for a nursing home's residents. Another classroom made bingo cards and checked off blocks when they complimented a classmate or did something nice for someone. The first grade practiced their manners. During a song about Mr. Manners that they performed for the rest of the school, Nicholas Wagoner was so animated that he even ended with a flourish, down on one knee. "We don't have to spend any money to do kind things for each other, do we?" Steele asked the student body, who responded with a cheer. Other classrooms cleaned their rooms to give the custodians a break, or made cards for staff members thanking them for what they do. One room filled a jar with suggestions for acts of kindness and then took turns drawing them out as their kindness assignment for the week. Some were simple things, such as holding the door for the person behind you, while others took more effort, such as cleaning up the living room at home. Second graders learned about being bucket fillers, that being kind or offering a smile is easy and makes them feel good. Their demonstration included a song, during which they held hands, except for Lamara Cliff, who sat in front of them with a bucket at her feet, holding up cards bearing words of kindness which she put into the bucket. Kindness is something you can do every single day, said Breon Martin. And now an article by Tony Reed, Historical Paths Are Retaken, from Decatur. The national road sliced across Illinois, carrying westbound early 19th century settlers and a sense of manifest destiny bundled up inside Conestoga wagons. But as amateur historian Don Chamberlain pointed out in a talk Sunday, little has changed in the gestation of major highway projects over the last 200 years. Chamberlain, speaking to a 50-strong crowd at Rock Springs Nature Center, said there had been disputes over whether the federal government ought to tax citizens to get the cash to build the road. After having flattened more bloody expansion opposition from Indian tribes, the national feeling to propel settlers westward triumphed. The full road, with construction starting in 1811, would stretch from Baltimore, Maryland, all the way to St. Louis. Chamberlain concentrated his talk on the stretch from Cumberland, Pennsylvania, to Vandalia, a length of 660 miles. Construction quality also echoed some of the roads we face today, as it was handled by government officials who contracted local help of varying abilities. So maybe one guy would be hired to do 5 miles, and then somebody else was hired to do another stretch, said Chamberlain, 73. So you can imagine the quality wasn't always so good. But the gravel road got the job done. Gradients weren't allowed to exceed a 5-degree pitch, and rivers were bridged and mountains crossed so plodding wagons, some weighing up to 10,000 pounds, could take the brave and hopeful toward new horizons. The road reached Vandalia by 1839 and then ground to a halt. There was no money left, explained Chamberlain. In later years, it would push on to St. Louis before being shunted into irrelevancy by the arrival of trains. But the road would enjoy a revival in the 1880s when lovers of the newfangled bicycle demanded a decent pedaling surface, and again in the 20th century thanks to the automobile's debut. The national road then became part of U.S. 40 in the 1920s until that was eclipsed in turn by Interstate 70 in the 1960s. Chamberlain, a retired high school biology teacher, kept the road talk fast-paced with many humorous intersections, and his hour-long presentation seemed to fly by. Audience member Carol Pels, a fellow retired teacher from Decatur, enjoyed the trip. It's easy to sit for an hour and listen to him, she said. He's got a good sense of humor. And then an article from Charleston by Dave Fope, a Lee News Service writer. Could that darn groundhog have been right? People who appreciated the warm weather on Saturday might have enjoyed it more than anyone in 86 years. The day's high temperature of 73 was 3 degrees higher than the previous record for the date, set in 1930, according to Cameron Craig, climatologist with the Eastern Illinois University Weather Center. The warm conditions started Friday, but that day's high of 64 degrees was 8 degrees below the all-time high, also from 1930, Craig said. He said cloudy conditions much of the day Friday hurt the chances for a record high that day as well. Craig said two weather systems combined to lead the spring-like conditions. A low-pressure system across the Great Lakes kept cold air to the north, while a high-pressure system to the east brought in warm air, he explained. It's a really good condition, Craig said, adding that the combination of systems was also the reason for the strong winds on Friday. He said the coming days will be cooler, but with temperatures in the mid-50s and upper 40s still above average for late February. March temperatures are expected to be near normal, with an average temperature about 42 degrees, Craig continued. And he noted, winter weather and the possibility of snow won't be completely out of the way for a month or more. We can see it swing back and forth, Craig said. We'll see another tongue of cold air. Nonetheless, the winter weather season that started in November has featured mostly higher than normal temperatures and far less than the long-term average for snowfall. The blizzard-like burst on Valentine's Day brought the area's season snowfall total to just more than 7 inches, Craig said. That's less than half of the 30-year average up to this point, nearly 16 inches. November until this week had an average daily temperature of 38.5 degrees, while the 30-year average is 34 degrees, he added. January and February so far both had average daily temperatures about 1 degree higher than normal, Craig added. January is typically the snowiest month of the winter, but the area only received about half of the 6-inch average, he said. And this article is followed by a photograph of fellows playing basketball, Eastern Illinois University students from left, Philip Valley, Max Smith, Lucas Bouchard, and Maxwell Stouffer play basketball on campus in Charleston. And from the opinion page by Esther Cepeda, advice, slow down and listen. Those of a certain age remember the bond forged with music emanating from the intimacy of a needle riding the grooves of a vinyl record. You may recall the accoutrements, the 45 RPM adapter, the velvet cylinder used to clean dust off the record, and maybe a penny for rebalancing the stylus head. Unless you had a super fancy sound system, you sat like Nipper, the famous RCA record label dog, close to a speaker, head cocked, listening intently for whatever it was that swelled your soul. Lyrics, instrumentation, a voice. You had a musical experience. Last month, after attending a particularly life-affirming piano concert, I began thinking about the outsized yet inconspicuous role music plays in our lives today. Music plays everywhere and is cheap, if not free, in any genre imaginable, at the click of a button. It will stream through your phone, iPad, computer, or any other device with access to the internet and go on without interruption, not caring whether you're paying attention to it or not. Even those of us who do purchase music find ourselves with a less than satisfying experience. You go to a website or an interface like iTunes, search for a song, pay a buck or so to download it, then play it through the computer or through your iPhone. In the unlikely event that you purchase a full album, you then have to store the thing in such a way that it will play back in order. Maybe not an issue for Taylor Swift's latest, but required for, say, Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon or a multiple movement symphony composed to be heard in a certain sequence. In contrast, I recently found a rack of used vinyl records at my local Goodwill store, and not only did I enjoy standing there combing through the stacks of LPs, but there was the album art to enjoy, the value of buying a whole album of carefully curated pieces of music for 99 cents, and the extensive liner notes. Liner notes! When was the last time you read an album's liner notes? Does popular music even bother to make them anymore? I came home with 15 albums of some of the most important orchestral music ever composed, played by the world's greatest orchestras in their prime, including the Boston Symphony Orchestra under Pierre Monteux, the Philadelphia Orchestra under Eugene Ormandy, and the Philharmonic Symphony Orchestra of New York under Leonard Bernstein. Gold, in other words, hours and hours of gold for 15 bucks. I bought a record player, shined up the vinyl, and sat down to listen to Bernstein conduct Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Overture Fantasy. You know the one. It's the romantic theme you hear in the kinds of ads where non-dairy butter-flavored spread meets heaving toast in a meadow, and they fall in love for your breakfast consumption pleasure. The piece, it turns dramatic, savage, syrupy, and mournful during its 20-minute length, didn't sound as crystal clear as it does in any of the many digital versions on my phone and computer. But then again, I wasn't making dinner or writing out bills while listening to it. I savored every crackle-infused silence and bordering on distorted crescendo. The liner notes were a hoot, recalling the twist of fate that resulted in Bernstein's 1943 Carnegie Hall debut. Musicologist Charles Burr further noted that Tchaikovsky wrote the fantasy under the thumb of his mentor, Miley Balakireff, and wasn't happy about it. Some say it was Balakireff who suggested an overture based on Romeo and Juliet. At any rate, Tchaikovsky had to listen to more advice on how to write it than he cared to, and complained in a letter to his brother Anatole, "He obliges me to be with him the whole day, and this is a great bore." A return visit to vinyl is not regression or nostalgia. It is a wistful act of slowing down, of relearning the pleasure of savoring, the self-control of concentrating, the challenge of looking at something old with new eyes. As life moves faster and faster, with real life and virtual spaces packed with sounds, messages, and images tailored to suck up every last fragment of our attention, the kindest thing we can do for ourselves is to slow down in some meaningful, nurturing way. If that means reading paper books, spending some time with yourself in silence, or really intently listening to whatever music you like without distraction, digitally or otherwise, do it. You won't regret it. And from the A3 Briefs for Monday, page A3, local pages, from Decatur, shed fire contained. Firefighters couldn't save a metal shed from burning down Saturday afternoon, but they stopped the flames from spreading to nearby buildings, including a garage and a house. The alarm was received about 3 p.m., and crews arrived at 3737 North Taylor Avenue to find the shed ablaze. Four pumpers and a ladder truck contained the fire. Damage to the shed was estimated at $2,000, with another $500 to the contents. The cause of the blaze is under investigation. Also from Decatur, beaten man, mum. Patrol officers say they were told in no uncertain terms that an intoxicated Decatur man, who had apparently been the victim of a beating early Saturday, had no intention of cooperating with them. Reports said the staff at a local service station in the 3700 block of North Woodford Street reported that the 29-year-old man arrived there about 3 a.m. with lacerations to his lower lip and a lump on his forehead, consistent with being beaten. But the reports say he refused to talk because he was not a snitch and did not like the police. The man was taken for hospital treatment, and officers filed a report classifying his injuries as aggravated battery, in case he changes his mind about cooperation. Also from Decatur, animal feeding session. The Macon County Conservation District will present preschool peepers, Feed the Animals, at 2 p.m. Sunday, February 28th at Rock Springs Nature Center. Children will hand-feed turtles and watch frogs gulp down their dinner during the free program. Pre-register online by Friday, February 26th at MaconCountyConservation.org. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, February 22nd, 2016. Please stay tuned. Thank you.